welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Laura Ströber, who is doing a PhD in Geological Sciences under the supervision of Dr. Ryan Mulligan and Dr. Pierre Pufau. Welcome to Grad Chat, Laura. Again, I should say. Welcome
yes,
again.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for having me back. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, it has been a while since you came on the show. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it was before you were about to do your comprehensives or something, or just after?
Right before the comprehensive exams, I came on to chat about my research, yeah.
And so now, though, you're coming on and you have defended. Congratulations.
That's thank you.
Pretty awesome.
Thank you.
So I guess a lot has happened between your comps and now.
Yes, yeah, the research has evolved substantially, yeah.
And you've enjoyed the whole process?
Oh, yeah. I've loved my entire time being a PhD student. It's a little bit bittersweet for it to come to a close because I've enjoyed it so much and I had so many opportunities to meet cool people and travel to nice places, but I'm also excited for the next step in my career.
Which will be?
I will be joining BGC Engineering as an earth scientist.
Fantastic.
At the Kingston office just downtown, so I'm not going far.
Well, that's fortuitous, isn't it? You don't have to move too far, which as you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very happy to be able to stay in Kingston.
And did you have opportunities to work with this company beforehand? Is that how you've managed to make this connection?
I made the connection because one of the employees for the company runs a course here at Queen's mm-hmm. through geological engineering called Five Hazards. And I came into the course for a guest lecture on coastal hazards. And so that started the connection. And then I maintained that connection up until now.
Which just goes to show, you know, networking during your degree is super,
yes.
super important. And as you said, you know, you might just meet someone once, but it's, as we always learn in networking, keep that person in mind and reach out to them every now and then, because you just never know
mm-hmm.
what's available for you around the corner.
Exactly. And it was really just a cold email that I sent to this individual to ask about the course and ask how I could be involved. So it all just starts with, you know, reaching out.
Reaching out.
Yeah.
Now we need to do more of that, particularly in this world.
Yes.
Where connections are really, really important. So, mm-hmm. you know, that was great that you learned that.
Thank you.
Now, coming back to your research, though, which you probably know really well now, since mm. you've defended it and everything, and just to remind people, it's on modern coastal processes.
Yes.
And looking, as it says, in coastal zones. I'm going to ask you a little bit about what does all that mean in terms of your research, because, you know, looking at the way coastal lines are eroding these days with mm-hmm. the craziness in our climate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't that long ago North Carolina had a huge storm and they were really worried about just on the normal news about erosion and things.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about what you were actually trying to accomplish during your research.
Mm-hmm.
What was the main focus, really?
I focused on the erosion that's occurring along the Barrier Islands of North Carolina.
Okay, well, there you go.
Exactly, yeah. Specifically, the developed portions. So I looked at Duck, North Carolina, and Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and those are very popular tourist destinations. There's lots of homes and businesses that are settled along the Barrier Island. And whenever we have a lot of development in those coastal zones, we have to manage the sediment budget very carefully because we're anchoring these very dynamic landscapes in one spot.
Right.
And they really want to move. The sand wants to be washed onto the Barrier Island. The Barrier Island itself wants to move landwards over time.
Right.
But because we have so much invested in those areas, we have to keep it in that same spot. So what ends up happening is the shoreline itself starts to kind of fall into the ocean, essentially. And in response, these areas along North Carolina re-nourish their beaches every 3 to 5 years, where they dredge sand from offshore, pump it onto the shoreline, and then use bulldozers to spread it around. And that's a very costly process,
well,
and it's a never-ending process as well.
Well, one begs to, well, ask the question, why are we building there when naturally the land doesn't want to do that, or yeah, the sea doesn't want to allow that to happen?
Well, the coastal zone is a very attractive area for recreation. It's also great for business. I think historically people settled along the coastline for navigation and ports and trade. So it's kind of just a legacy of, you know, the economics of the time, and then just also it's a beautiful area, so people naturally gravitate towards it. But it is becoming more and more challenging with sea level changes to stay in those areas. A lot of people are starting to put their homes on trucks and relocate their homes inland, because in certain parts of the Outer Banks, homes are literally falling into the ocean, where the shoreline has reached the base of the homes and has eroded the foundation. And it becomes a very challenging problem for the communities to manage, because there's a lot of debris and the septic tank is now outflowing into the ocean. And these are areas that people are swimming and enjoying themselves. And you have all of these new complications as this problem is becoming more critical.
Which, as you said, increases the cost of or the budgets of those particular townships and things.
Yes. And then that raises questions about access to the beach, because it's becoming more of a reality that in order to have access to the beach, you have to be wealthy. So you have to have the flood insurance. You have to have the capability to install the mitigation measures to protect your house. Maybe you have to move your house, or you have to help your community invest in these nourishment efforts. So it's becoming this kind of socioeconomic challenge as well, and an equity challenge. So there's all sorts of different layers when it comes to the coastal zone, which makes it a very fascinating area to study.
Well, yeah, because I guess it's constantly changing at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
And probably faster than perhaps it should be.
Definitely, yeah, the sea levels are rising at an accelerated rate. So it's not even just the eustatic sea level rise, which is just the elevation in water due to the additional meltwater from the glaciers, right, but you also have the land responding, and in some areas the land is sinking. So that's called relative sea level rise, and that's why in certain areas around the world the sea levels are rising faster, and it's because the land is sinking while simultaneously the sea level is rising.
There's going to be more Venices in the world.
Yes, yes. So, the sinking of the land can be due to groundwater withdrawal.
Right.
Another common kind of contributor is the isostatic adjustment of the land, which basically means that, you know, thousands of years ago we had glaciers kind of near kind of Virginia, that area. And just south of those glaciers, the land was uplifted slightly because the glaciers were so heavy and had so much mass that they sank the land where they immediately overlapped. And so the surrounding areas, almost like a trampoline, bulged upwards. Right. And now the glaciers are gone. They've retreated. And so the land is slowly starting to readjust to that loss of mass. And so that response is also adding another layer of complexity.
Wow, because I hadn't even thought about the glaciers and what they could potentially
do.
Because I know you're looking at the coast and you think, what's coming in from the sea? But you're right in the way that, you know, the land itself has had to move itself around.
Yeah.
And some of that's through glaciers, and some of it could have been from volcanoes, et cetera, that are popping up on land as opposed to in the sea.
Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of different responses, because the tectonic plates are really just floating on this kind of more plastic material underneath. So it is a little bit squishy. We can't really, we don't notice the squishiness in our day-to-day life. But, you know, over the time scales of, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years, the squishiness is very important.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I know I'm going off the coast here a little bit, but even here in Kingston with all the limestone that we have, you can tell even in your own backyard that the limestone rocks are shifting.
Yeah.
And things, because water's turning up in areas that hadn't turned up 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Because it's clearly found a different path.
Yeah. Water will always find a path through rock, and it can cause, erosion and the shifting of different, you know, bedrock planes as well.
So that's, we clearly need to study rocks a little bit more, don't we?
Rocks are important.
rocks are important. Okay, so back to the beaches, you know, your modern coastal processes. What is beach nourishment? And why might a community nourish their beaches?
Beach nourishment is the artificial replacement of sand. So the community has identified that an intervention is needed.
Right.
And there's other options, but they're usually kind of gray infrastructure options like seawalls or revetments or bulkheads, things like that. But in a lot of areas where recreation is important, you want it to remain as natural looking as possible, and you want a nice large beach for people to enjoy. So oftentimes nourishment is your best bet. However, because you are kind of artificially redesigning the profile of the beach, the sea wants to bring it back into that original equilibrium.
Right.
So inevitably, whenever a nourishment project occurs, it is expected that the sand will not stay there forever. It's going to move.
So all that sand they're dumping in every few years, as you said, is eventually going to go back into the sea.
It's either going to go back into the sea, which is called cross-shore transport, so moving it back towards the ocean, or it can move down the shoreline. So one community nourishing their beach can actually benefit the communities down the shoreline, because there's a very strong current that runs along the shoreline, parallel to the shoreline, and that continuously draws sand south in my field site. So the longshore current runs south. Like I said, it's kind of a never-ending process. Once you start, it's really hard to stop nourishing your beach.
So talk about these currents, because I know coming from Australia, whenever we go in the sea, we're always told by the lifeguard people, watch out for the currents and the rips and things like that. So there's the currents, but then there's the rips where you can get caught.
Yeah.
Tell us about how this works, because you said they have a current that runs kind of like parallel. But are they strong currents? Do they have rips in them? And what effect does the rip actually have?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's lots of nearshore currents. And the two directions that most people study are moving offshore. Those are the cross-shore currents, and then moving along the shoreline. The ones that run along the shoreline occur primarily within the surf zone. So if you're at a beach, at a sandy beach with lots of waves, and you're playing in the waves, you may notice that if you look up, you're moving slowly or rapidly down the shoreline.
Yes, sometimes rapidly, which is the scary one.
Yeah, because they can be upwards of, you know, 2 meters a second. So if you're not paying attention, you may end up, you know, several land parcels down away from where you originally entered the ocean.
Or getting closer to the rocks.
Exactly. You really need to pay attention. But every once in a while, that longshore current reroutes itself and escapes back out towards the ocean. And those are commonly known as rip currents. And those are quite scary because people, you know, can feel that they're being pulled farther and farther away from the shoreline. Oftentimes they try to, you know, fix the situation by swimming right back towards land. But because it's a very steady and strong current, they can end up exhausting themselves. And that's why rip currents are so hazardous to swimmers.
So what should they do? Because I've been caught in a rip and I did exactly what you said I shouldn't do.
Yeah,
which is why I had to get rescued.
It's very scary. It's not a great feeling.
No, it's not.
Well, the first thing that, you know, swimmers can do is to swim in areas with lifeguards.
Yes.
So pay attention to what the lifeguards are saying. Pay attention to if there's any flags up. If you don't understand what a flag is, ask the lifeguard, what does this mean for the conditions for the day? Because oftentimes they will mark the locations where rip currents are currently happening or may happen. So the other thing to keep in mind is that there's been lots of research on how to respond to rip currents effectively. There was a recent study that came out where they put kind of GPS trackers on swimmers, and they were very strong swimmers, and they told them, you know, to either swim parallel to the shoreline or to rest and just kind of allow the current to take them where it may.
Right.
And they actually found that in many cases, these rip currents can recirculate back towards the surf zone on the time scale of about 7 to 10 minutes. So if you're willing to kind of just...
To hope.
Yeah, if you're willing to rest, you may end up just recirculating back towards the surf zone, but slightly kind of away from the rip current, and kind of plumes outwards and curls back towards the shoreline. Because also keep in mind that the rip current isn't going to suck you out, you know, kilometers away from the shoreline. It really only escapes about one extra length away from the surf zone. So if you look at the width of a surf zone, the rip current will die off really rapidly as soon as you exit the surf zone. And you can still feel it a little bit, but it spreads out and it slows down a lot as soon as you leave the surf zone. And they found that actually only in 10% of cases did the swimmers actually get sucked out outside of the surf zone. Mm. So the general advice when you're in a rip current is to not swim back towards the shoreline, which that's true.
So don't fight it.
Don't fight the current. First thing to do is relax, kind of pay attention to where you may be going. The next thing to do is to consider, if you're a strong enough swimmer, to swim parallel to the shoreline. So ideally that is running, you know, perpendicular to the rip current itself.
Right.
However, there are still longshore currents. And in some cases, those longshore currents can also be strong. So you need to make sure that you're not fighting the rip, but you're also not fighting the longshore current. So I would say if you're finding yourself caught in a rip, to, you know, take a moment to float and calm down and analyze your trajectory. Are you moving rapidly offshore and are you moving downshore? And then to swim with, you know, in tandem with that longshore current. So to allow the longshore current to help you escape the rip current, as opposed to choosing the wrong shore parallel location. Now you're fighting a different sort of current.
Right.
So it is a little bit complicated to do it, you know, very efficiently and effectively.
So at the end of the day, keep an eye on what the lifeguards tell you.
Yes, yeah.
And you don't get caught in that.
Yeah, and if you're in an area that's not lifeguarded, but you still want to swim, what you can do is assess the area before you enter the water, because in many cases, the rip currents are occurring in locations where there's a gap in the sandbar.
So basically, and that's what I always remembered. There was mm-hmm. you get sand when you're in the surf. You have these sandbars, but then you have these deep trenches.
Exactly.
So it's the trench, right?
Yes, that trench acts as basically a drain pipe for any water that wants to move offshore. It's going to route right through that channel. It's called a rip channel. And so usually you can see lots of foamy breaking waves over those sandbars. Mm-hmm. And then there's often a gap in the breaking waves. So there's less foam. The waves actually, to an untrained eye, it looks like the perfect spot to go swimming because you don't see those crashing waves. You don't see the turbulence.
Right.
But in fact, if you look very closely, in some cases, you can see residual foam moving very slowly out towards the sea, or you can even see sediment plumes. So the color of the water may change because the rip current is kind of excavating and bringing up a whole bunch and entraining a whole bunch of sediment into the water column. So there's a couple of clues that you can look for before you enter the water to avoid a rip current.
So, I mean, it's great now and I know what I should have done. But in terms of erosion of the mm-hmm. coastal line, so if we've got these trenches and they're picking up sediment and mm-hmm. chucking it out, is that why having these rip currents are not good for the coast as well? Or is it good to have them?
Well, that's a good question.
In terms of erosion.
Generally speaking, rip currents kind of pop up in random and different locations, and they do pull sediment offshore. And depending on the strength of the rip current, they may pull the sediment sufficiently offshore that it's difficult to recover that sediment back.
Okay.
So sometimes the rip current is so fast that it's bringing the sediment really far offshore, and the sediment will never see the beach ever again.
Right.
And like I said, usually the rip currents are not in one location steady over time. However, there are certain areas along the Outer Banks where rip currents do seem to be reinforced by the natural geology of the area. So rip currents are more likely in those zones. And when you have that sort of situation, then you're more continuously transporting that sediment offshore where it can be a problem.
So what are those geological things that make them happen more often?
That's a really good question. So the underwater topography is referred to as bathymetry.
That's a good word.
Is influenced by, you know, geological bedrock sequences that were established a long time ago. And in my study site at Kitty Hawk, there's a sequence of very strange undulations in the bathymetry.
Oh.
We call them shore oblique bars and troughs because they're basically kind of these permanent sandbars and channels that connect to the shoreline at an angle. And we find that in those areas, especially if there's really high wave heights, so maybe a 2-meter size wave or higher, that those like geological structures end up inducing the conditions to create rip currents like fairly frequently in the exact same position.
Right. And so that's not helping with the erosion at all.
And at a regional scale, those geological signatures have been statistically linked to higher rates of erosion. But it's difficult to study the exact dynamics and the exact processes in detail because it's such a spatially continuous zone. Waves, especially stormy conditions, are challenging to study safely. And so my research aimed to investigate those dynamics with a combination of modeling and remote sensing. So those were some good strategies to use in this particular case.
So, but how does that work if you've got sensors and things? Because if it's constantly changing, I mean, I guess the sensors are picking that up. But it's still a fairly big area, isn't it? And who knows what's happening with storms, just with and even without storms, the normal movements of the sea, tides, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there were no installed sensors in the ocean at Kitty Hawk, but there are sensors kind of scattered around the surrounding area. So particularly Duck, North Carolina has a series of sensors permanently installed because it's a site studied by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
And the sensors are from 4 meters depth all the way out to kind of really offshore deep depths. And they do have to be maintained fairly regularly because, you know, they can get buried under kind of extreme conditions. Mm-hmm. But biofouling is another challenge whenever we're dealing with sensors in the ocean. Biofouling. Yeah, basically like mussels and clams and different living organisms can encrust themselves. And then also just salt. Salt water is really challenging. So it is, you know, it is difficult to maintain any sort of permanent sensor fields in the ocean. But I really just use those installed sensors to calibrate my numerical model to make sure that my model is matching what those sensors are saying at those really, you know, because the sensors are only covering a very small point in space. So I can calibrate my numerical model to make sure that those points in space are accurate. And then you kind of assume that the model is resolving the relevant dynamics properly. And that's essentially what I did. So I calibrated the model and then analyzed Kitty Hawk. And then I also had a radar, a remote sensing system out to capture several storm events. And that is something that sits kind of along the dune line and can just kind of send out electromagnetic signals, and it records the backscatter of those signals. And it turns out that the radar data is really good at picking up the crests of waves. So I can actually track each individual wave that's approaching the coastline and how it's bending, how it's breaking. And that paired with the numerical model really offered a lot of insights into what's happening at Kitty Hawk.
And then once you've got, now you've got that model, then you can look and say, no, if we get, for instance, a storm of this caliber with the waves at this height, this is the expected erosion. Is that what you basically you're trying to do?
Yeah, exactly. So my first couple of kind of research pieces used a model that just had a static bed. And then the last half of my dissertation, we used a different model that can actually simulate the movement of the sediment. Mm-hmm. But that's a little bit more of a challenging process because not only are you trying to get the waves and the currents correct, but you're also trying to make sure that the sediment is moving in a way that makes sense and is accurate and representative. But we did find, we resolved a series of representative storms. So we wanted storms of various intensities and various durations. So we simulated a whole sequence, and we found that the storm conditions really controlled the volume or the magnitude of sediment that was being moved. But those bathymetric features, those oblique bars and troughs, really controlled the locations where erosion was intense and where deposition or where the placement of sediment was intense.
So it's interesting that you're doing this because, I mean, you certainly can't do this on every beach in up and down the East Coast of North America or any other place, to be honest. So what are you hoping to gain from this knowledge? You just help those particular communities, or is it something that then can be looked at to be used in other places that have the potential to have a major effect on humans?
Yeah.
and then everything else in between.
I think kind of the global takeaway from the research is to acknowledge that kind of geological structures and the bathymetry of the ocean can play a role in really exacerbating erosion in local spots.
Right.
So if a community has elected to manage erosion, it's really good to keep in mind that you may have this kind of persistent feature that's just going to make your life difficult forever.
Right.
And we do find very similar geological structures occurring around the world. So because these structures were originally created by really old paleo riverine channels that ran through coastal zones during the last glacial maximum.
Okay.
So during the last glacial maximum, sea levels were much lower because all the water was stored in the glaciers. And therefore, where presently we have coastal areas, it was riverine areas. So rivers ran through these areas once, you know, long ago. And so we're finding very similar structures in Florida, in Texas, all along North Carolina, also Long Island. And then there's a very interesting study that came out of PEI, and it's not an ancient riverine channel that is kind of inducing these rip currents. It's actually an old river that we engineered to reroute in order to place a road and a parking lot for beach access. Oh. So they rerouted this river, moved it into a kind of pond that gets outflowed to the ocean at a different location. And it's very interesting. They used satellite imagery to track the location of rip currents, and they found that rip currents were continuously happening at the old outflow
right.
of the original river location.
Right.
So it can happen under a variety of circumstances via a variety of means, but it's just good to keep in mind that the topography underneath the water that we don't often pay attention to can be kind of reinforcing
right.
certain hydrodynamic conditions.
Well, I think it comes down to the usual. Sometimes we shouldn't upset the natural balance.
Yeah.
You know, if a river says it wants to go here, let it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, as you showed in that PEI, moving it to mm-hmm. even only 10 meters or even 100 meters
yeah.
can have a huge impact.
Exactly. And it's kind of a very interesting story because they moved the river to make a beach access point
yes.
and then they encountered these rip currents.
It
it's like, oh, shoot, like this,
yeah. Whoops.
This is not great. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see if they moved it back, got rid of that, you know, moved the river back to where it was, whether it would fix itself again.
And yeah, that's a very interesting question. Yeah, they'd have to change kind of the beach access point, but yeah.
Which is probably the better thing, what they should have done in the first place. So how do human decisions influence the natural evolution of coastal systems, which we've just seen an example of that?
Yeah, well, so that's the thing. Like I said kind of at the beginning of this conversation, whenever we decide to develop or live on these coastal zones, we are committing ourselves to anchoring, you know, the beach in that particular position.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't want to do that, you know, over the time scale of centuries. It really wants to be dynamic and move. So what we end up doing is whenever, you know, the beach gets washed onto the roadways, we move the sediment back onto the beach, or
right.
we end up, you know, reinforcing or elevating dunes. You know,
mm-hmm.
we create artificial dunes, which blocks the sediment from entering kind of the back barrier or the inland area. And so those human decisions by, you know, deciding to reinforce the coastline and then also moving the sediment back into the original position, it's preventing the coastline from evolving in the way that it wants to maintain its equilibrium
right.
with the sea level.
Right.
So human decisions on developed coastlines are basically the dominant, you know, decision maker for the landscape.
Which kind of maybe we shouldn't be making the decisions for the landscape.
Yeah, there's pros and cons. There's
yeah.
definitely pros and cons, but it's just difficult when we put ourselves in such difficult positions, you know, because we're kind of creating these problems for ourselves.
Yes.
And if we had just kind of respected the natural order and maybe thought about that a little bit before we got to this point, then we wouldn't have as much, you know, home damage or,
right.
you know, economic losses.
And insurance premiums wouldn't have gone up so high.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, the beach is lovely and everybody
beautiful.
Would love to, you know, live on the beach. But, you know, it's a very aggressive landscape. There's storms. the land doesn't want to stay in that one spot. No. So it is challenging.
A bit of food for thought there, I think. Yeah. I mean, I used to say that always about, you know, people who build themselves on a fault line. Mm-hmm. Why would you do that? You know, at some stage there's going to be an earthquake.
Yeah. It's all about balancing risk and what your personal perception of risk is. And that's a whole nother kind of line of research that's very interesting, is why do some people perceive things as being risky and other people just kind of think it's perfectly fine and is safe? It's very interesting psychologically.
So those two communities you were looking at, they clearly want to keep living on the coast.
Oh, of course.
So they'll do whatever's needed. In fact, they're probably really...
For now. Yes.
Were they happy that this research is getting done?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the community is very happy that there's a lot of research being done in these areas. And especially when you're partnered with the Army Corps of Engineers, you generally have a lot of support from industry and government and the community. And it's always good to have further insight about why rip currents may be occurring. And I did reach out to the lifeguards in the area to ask, you know, are you guys tracking rip currents? What sort of data do you have? So, yeah, it's always good to try to understand these complex problems as best as you can.
Yeah, it's getting the data, though, as you said, isn't always easy. But luckily, you've got some ways of easier ways of measuring it than most places.
Yes, exactly.
Which is really good. So that could be a lifelong project for someone, but you don't have to worry about that right now because you've got another job that you're going to.
Yeah,
which is fantastic. So you talked about I like the fact that you talked about the waves and things. Mm-hmm. And of course, here at Queen's, we have that wave tank, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Did you practice some of your models in that wave tank or anything like that?
Yeah, we have several wave tanks. So on the western side of campus, kind of near the football stadium, there's a whole coastal lab where we have a large basin. We have tsunami flumes. I also have a very small wave tank that we predominantly use for outreach purposes.
Right.
We use it whenever we have summer camps or
fantastic.
Kind of K-12 kids coming through. And then we also brought it to Science Rendezvous this past year, which we really enjoyed. So predominantly we use it to kind of run these small experiments and engage the public in order to kind of, you know, spread the word about the research that's occurring at Queen's. It was also used for some calibration by some other research students in my group. So just to test out some sensors and some small techniques kind of on a smaller scale, just because that wave tank is a lot more accessible than getting yourself out to West Campus and kind of filling a large tank and kind of committing to that. So it's a nice, you know, small testing ground, but predominantly it's for science communication.
Do they also use it for things like, because, I mean, from between here and up to Ottawa and the Rideau Canal system and everything, I mean, there's erosion things going on there because of the waterways and particularly motorboats on the waterways. Have they used it in terms of looking at that? Because similar to the coastline, we're looking at what is the erosion of our landlines from the water, from the lakes. The shores of the lakes and the rivers and things. So has it been used for things like that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Yeah, so, you know, ship wake is a large contributor to erosion. And we have people in my research group that simulate the Lake Ontario and the water levels and the waves. Those particular models don't simulate erosion, but they're more so just to give a forecast about the water conditions.
Right.
And then we have another group of people who are doing the physical basin simulations, and those are largely kind of theoretical simulations where we're really trying to hone in on a particular wave parameter. So the wave basin is really good at studying different wave angles and how different wave angles affect the run-up of water on the beach. So it's kind of a very precise and kind of theoretical exploration there. And then we also have a group of people who are really good at analyzing landslide-induced tsunamis and how we can design different catchments to prevent landslides from hitting water. If the landslide hits water, what does the wave look like? So that's kind of a whole another line of research that's occurring and is really impressive. It's really cool to see when they have experiments running. But we don't have anybody precisely who is kind of replicating the particular conditions of like the infrastructure of Lake Ontario to analyze erosion mm-hmm. that's happening here yet.
Because again, with all these beautiful waterways that we have here, we're very lucky how much fresh water and things. Everyone wants to have a cottage.
Yes.
Right on the water.
Yes.
But they also then let motorboats in and those skidoo things, which are always coming way too close to shore.
Yeah.
And you can see very easily how much it pushes and pushes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. It is actually a really big problem. And there's lots of studies coming out of the States that kind of quantify ship wake and how that particular contribution will drive erosion. Yeah, I don't know of anything that's happened, especially since lake systems are not necessarily my kind of area of expertise. I don't know of what's currently, you know, the state of the art research there, but it is an interesting question.
Well, I guess they don't have the currents, and they have currents in different ways, but not quite like they would on a coastline.
Yeah, yeah. You have lake turnover and you have all sorts of different processes that are happening that I don't necessarily worry about as much on the coast.
Well, you got plenty plenty to do.
Yes.
And you know, Laura, I really appreciate you coming back on the show, because it's
thank you.
To be honest, this is one of those topics too which affects all of us, really, because we do love the shoreline.
Yeah,
we do love going to the beach. We may not like always the salt water, but we do like going to the beach. And it would be a shame if we could never enjoy the beach. As long as we do our due diligence of looking after and not contributing to erosion, which unfortunately human beings are very good at contributing
to a problem. I think, a lot of these developed areas kind of will end up hitting a tipping point where the economics just don't make sense anymore. Like what you're required to invest just surpasses what you get out of tourism or like real estate. So there are some difficult decisions, you know, inevitably, you know, in the future for these areas. But it just means that we have to reassess how we utilize and how we manage those areas. And maybe it means that, you know, we conserve more of them in their natural state, and then we can enjoy them as parks and visit them in different ways.
In different ways, yeah. On the conservation side. Still have some people having the opportunity, but not everyone.
Yes.
And I guess with the work and the models that you're doing, that will help predict some of those things.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Like if they're starting a new development, you know, probably not a good idea because of this. Save some economics there. So thank you.
Thank you.
Congrats again.
Thank you.
It's always exciting when I know someone's defended. So that's great.
Yeah, it's a good feeling.
And good luck with the new job. I hope
you're
enjoying it. So
thank you.
Good luck with that.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week. This is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.